WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media Station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. President Trump announcing on social media he's reached a trade deal with South Korea. In addition to a 15% tariff on South Korean goods, the country's agreeing that South Korea will spend hundreds of billions on U.S. energy and investments. The tariff for India, 25%.
The president says it's because India's tariffs on products that we export there are just too high, that they haven't opened their market to American products. And there's a reason then he's going to put this very steep 25% tariff then on the goods that we bring into this country from India.
ABC's Karen Travers. The Fed announcing interest rates will stay put for now, the decision after today's better-than-expected GDP report. In a deal with the Trump administration to get back federal funding, Brown University will pay $50 million to Rhode Island's workforce development organizations, and it'll adopt the government's definition of male and female and has to remove any consideration of race from the admissions process. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers bow to the Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports. Baseball, the Brewers losing at home to the Cubs today, 10-3. Chicago with 8 hits for extra bases, the most Milwaukee has given up since opening weekend in New York when the Yankees had 11 in a single game with their torpedo bats. Starting pitcher Freddie Peralta struggled, walking 4 batters, giving up 5 earned runs in just 4 innings. A bright spot, though, William Contreras had his first home run in 6 weeks and then hit another out of the park later on. The Brewers remain in first place in the NL Central, one game ahead of the Cubs. Jackson Chourio did not play today. He's dealing with what's described as a mild hamstring injury. Up next, they head to Washington tomorrow to open a series against the Nationals on Friday night. NFL, Packers in team meetings. They resume training camp practice tomorrow morning at 10:30. That's open to the public. On Saturday, they have family night inside Lambeau Field, a 2-hour practice in pads. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
A new choice. Madison's real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. All right, brothers and sisters, grab a seat. Maybe one of those union-made folding chairs if you can still find one, because it's time to talk about freedom. Yep, freedom in America, 2025 version. Freedom. Remember that thing we were promised as kids? Yeah, right now the people running the joint are treating it like clearance Halloween candy. They hand it out to whomever they like, and then they lock the rest into storage. But let's start at the top. The president, guy who's sits in the Oval Office, embracing an interventionist version of the economy. Sounds official. Sounds good. Sounds like it might actually work from a business guy. Sounds like, to me, government picking winners and losers. And there used to be a political party, his, that used to cry about this. And understand, not all of us are going to be lucky in this interventionalist economy. Just the loyal, you know, the people who their companies showed up with big campaign checks, the people who can name their favorite Trump executive order. And meanwhile, if you work with your hands, punch a clock, or just hope to keep your health insurance for another quarter, you get higher prices. You get the threat of layoffs, and, well, they're going to call that national security, which in 2025 is the new catch-all. It's the new catchphrase. It's the new, we want to deflect away from really talking about anything, so it's going to be national security. And yes, for that national security, going to cost you more, but it's going to help Trump's friends. And if you think that's bad, there's more. While you're working the double shift to pay the double price groceries, the government's out there, the Trump government's out there shaking down universities and law firms like they're mobsters in a movie. Nice endowment you got there, Harvard. Shame if something happened to it. And look, if you're a school that teaches the wrong thing, or heaven forbid, a law firm that defends the wrong client, that investigation time, which that's not democracy. That's intimidation by press release. And before you know it, who's going to have the guts to speak up when your rights get trampled? The clock's ticking. And for all of those who keep silent, remember when it's your turn in the crosshairs. Because, you know, look, every sitcom starts with a laugh track. We get the shiny executive order on religious freedom. Really? And this, is, to me, is another one of those fun moments. They claim it's just about welcoming people of faith. And don't get me wrong, in a true democracy, everyone gets to keep their faith. And people get to have no faith. But this executive order, this latest Trump memo, it's actually going to let you proselytize. Yeah, you know, you're going to be able to go out there and promote your religion to your coworkers. You get to challenge their beliefs, tell them how stupid they are. Correct them. Move them. Urge them to the correct faith. Maybe even join the prayer circle at lunchtime. And look, I can't wait for that. Now, sure, it could be harassment, but they're saying, no, you can't harass people with this. Good luck on that. Because remember when your supervisor decided that that wasn't harassment or it wasn't bullying? Did that go well? I mean, get this in your head. You're going to go to the DMV. It's going to look a lot less like a workplace and more like high school debate club with mandatory Bible study. And say the wrong thing. Do the wrong thing. Believe the wrong thing. Tell your supervisor you're not interested in his lunchtime sermon. Good luck. Good luck at your next performance review, kid. Maybe you get a good assignment. Maybe you don't. Don't want to talk about your faith? Now you're hostile to the company culture. That's not protecting religious freedom. That's putting a litmus test on liberty. That's saying the government, the Trump government, a government that's supposed to serve everyone equally, now has a preference. And if you don't figure out which way the wind's blowing today, duck. Let's be clear. Democracy is not supposed to be about the one who yells the loudest, who waves the biggest cross, or gets the nicest spot at the Chamber of Commerce prayer breakfast. Democracy means whether you're Baptist or Buddhist or Jewish or none, you get the same shot, the same respect. You don't get bullied into or out of your beliefs or your job or your housing. And yet, here's the con. Every one of these moves, shaking down universities, picking winners and losers in the market, making workplaces full of religious zealots who see it as their battleground, this isn't freedom. They substitute real freedom. You know, the messy, sometimes annoying equality of democracy for a version where the powerful, the wealthy, they get to pick their favorites and call it a virtue. If you're not in the right club, you're just in the wrong way. This isn't some bad dream, folks, or a plot for the next Netflix drama. This is what happens piece by piece when a government, a Trump government, stops fearing the people and starts making them fear each other and themselves. This is how liberty dies, not in a coup, but with a memo, not with a dictator with a funny hat, but with a president holding your groceries hostage and your job just one prayer circle away from being slashed. Real freedom means nobody can force you into or on your knees or into anything. Nobody, not even the president. They don't get to decide what goes on in your head or your heart or your home, but this is what we're seeing. This is where we are. This moment, right now, we've got an administration that is fundamentally changing this country in ways that I don't think many of us thought possible. I know my right-wing friends, they like to talk about, you know, getting out there and Christianizing the world. Donald Trump just made an executive order that the federal government will be that battleground. And my mind goes to fun places, because what happens when the first Muslim guy shows up with his prayer rug? Will this executive order protect him or allow for the rest of the workplace to convince him how wrong he is? If I show up with a colander on my head claiming to be a Pastafarian, what will that look like? And will the law protect me equal? The answer, no. We know where they want to take this. We know what this is going to look like. And this is mob rule. That's not democracy. This is feeding the egos of the donor class. The question is, how long are we going to put up with it? Like I said, whether it's law firms or education or you know, whether your kid gets to play football or baseball, I'm wondering what's next. How far do they go? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Can it get worse? Do you expect it to get worse? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like a school district in Tennessee is taking a page from the corporatist playbook. It's one of those things that made me wonder, was this something maybe out of Project 2025? Did they have anything on this? So I went through and I checked out Project 2025, and no. Their education policy was destroy the Department of Education and privatize student loans. So and obviously move towards privatization of education as a whole. But this case, the school district, Lawrence County School Systems there in Tennessee, their officials are moving towards a policy that will teach students work ethic and reliability by not allowing them to miss any days of school. They said that, you know, as adults, they're going to be expected to show up to work. If they get hurt, if they get sick, show up to work. Going to work? After 3 days of absenteeism, you will then have intervention. After 8 days, they're going to refer you to the court system. And you got to wonder, you know, is this the Trump effect as we're going after schools, dismantling the Department of Education, shaking down universities? I don't know. Here to share some thoughts on that and whatever we can jump in with the education policy. I've asked Ken Mash to come talk with us. He's the president of APSCUF. They represent Pennsylvania's higher education professionals. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Rick.
So what do you think of this policy? You know, we got to teach kids work ethic, Ken. Got to get them some work ethic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's caught up with this idea that business is, you know, the answer to everything, as if business itself does such a great job. You have to start off with the basic principle that, you know, when it comes to public goods, right, there isn't a profit motive. And the profit motive should not be what drives things. And, you know, we just see that increasingly happening both in the private schools. We saw it with prisons. We see it with private schools. We're even seeing it with some universities, too, as, you know, private textbook companies are trying to do more and more with AI and get more of an inroads into public universities.
So, you know, in looking at this, and this is where I go, I'm watching what Trump is doing with Columbia First and now Harvard and other elite universities. I view it as a shakedown, but again, you've got a president who's, you know, hole into interventionalism, so much for freedom. What do you think of what's going on at those universities? Or are you one of the people who thinks, you know, maybe they earned this, maybe they deserve it?
No, I don't think that they've earned it. Look, I'm not going to defend every action that Harvard or any of the other universities took, particularly during the times of the protests. But, you know, we shouldn't pretend. And, you know, the reason that they're giving for doing this thing is, you know, protecting against anti-Semitism. But when you look at what they've been asking for, it doesn't have to do with anti-Semitism. It has to do, you know, in the case of the University of Pennsylvania, had to do with transgender athletes. When you look at the letter that was originally sent to Harvard, it was about, you know, them determining whether or not Harvard had an appropriate political balance among their faculty. It was about instructing them what they should and shouldn't teach. There was a long list of horribles that were included. So this is, you know, this is about an enemies list and the Trump administration going after those people that they consider to be a threat. And also, when we stop and look at it, you ask, you know, when it comes to actual democracies, you know, what do they have in common? And it is universities where there's free and open thought. And so it makes perfect sense that the Trump administration would be going after these institutions, particularly the elite ones.
So does it trickle down to you, or are you guys just small potatoes? They want to go after the quote unquote elites. Does this affect you guys?
Well, you know, it affects us in various ways, because when they go after, you know, NSF, when they go after, which is the National Science Foundation, or NIH, the National Institute for Health, and the research dollars that they provide, while we don't do things on the same scale as some of the research institutions do, we still, at our public regionals, are doing research. On top of which, you know, those people who are educated, who go to teach at our universities, got their doctorates and got to understand their fields at these universities. So when they start attacking these institutions, they are really attacking all of higher education.
No, you know, the concept of an injury to one being an injury to all, because you're mm-hmm. all in the same fish tank or the shark tank. It's all going to come down to you. And ultimately, you know, aren't universities and colleges supposed to be the place where we have academic freedom, where we don't have a fascist leader saying you have to learn this and I'm going to punish you if you talk about this? It seems, you know, that slippery slope argument my friends on the right love to throw around seems like a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, for them, they look at the faculty and they may say, and, you know, they make all the arguments that the faculty has a liberal bent, which may or may not be true. But, you know, they somehow translate that into the fact that there's brainwashing going on at these institutions. And if there really truly was brainwashing or an attempt to brainwash, at the very least, we could all agree that universities have not done a good job. If that's what their goal is, to turn people into liberals and the rest, we wouldn't have Trump if that was the case, right? Look, we need universities because we need academic freedom. A lot of people don't particularly like that term, but we do need the ability of faculty to pursue research freely without interference from government. We need for professors to talk about difficult subjects.
Yeah, I mean, academic autonomy would be a much, much better phrase, I think.
Yeah, probably. That's good. You know, and we need people to put the ideas out there. Some of the best students I have had in my career, I did not agree with at all. But it was through the course of conversation that they got to hone, you know, even if they were all the way on the right and I was much more liberal, in the course of conversation and in going back and forth, they got to hone their own ideas, right? Because they're in college, and what passes for argument in a bar or passes for argument in, you know, among family members doesn't hold water when you get to college. So if you want to maintain your ideas, even if you're conservative, you have to be able to be in a position to defend those ideas and to defend them in a way that is logical, that is backed with evidence, which, you know, I guess that matters less and less evidence nowadays.
Well, but, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'll go back to what I started off this segment with the story from Tennessee. There are a lot of people who think an education is just about getting a job and what you can bring to an employer. It's not about what you just talked about, defending your own ideas or honing your own opinions or being a well-rounded person. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about the job. It's all about, you know, very transactional. And, you know, these are your skills. This is what it's worth and that kind of stuff. Do you see that? I mean, or am I putting too much of that?
No, I think we've been dealing with that in higher education in particular over the last couple of decades, where there's been this attack on higher education just in terms of, you know, are you getting a job and what's the cost of it? And you can, by the way, make the argument still that college education is worth it if you want to talk about it in those terms. But, you know, a college education gives you so much more than just simply a job. It gives you a way of viewing the world. It gives you the ability to understand the world that is going on around you, to appreciate where we are in history and what has preceded us. All of those things are important for making solid decisions. And, you know, and it teaches you, and even if we want to talk about jobs, right? The thing that makes the American higher education system, or did make it in the past, the envy of the world, was the fact that we were able to get across critical, you know, important, you know, fundamental ideas that are good for work and the rest. But on top of that, that you have critical thinking that goes on, and you teach people how to think critically. And you can't teach people to think critically if, you know, a curriculum is being imposed on you, right? Because that means you're not even thinking about what the curriculum is or what is getting across. So, you know, we lose out. We lose out in so many different ways. You know, Scott Galloway, I don't know if you know who that is. He's a professor at NYU and he has some podcasts. But he makes a very simple argument. If you look at what the Trump administration has done as far as barring foreign students from coming into the United States, right? Not wanting them to learn at our universities, making it so much harder, that as far as a value proposition goes, like that, we were making out so well. Like people, other countries were sending us their best.
Yep.
And they were staying here, right? And contributing in technology and science and so many other fields. And we're gonna lose that.
Because, yeah, and taking back our values with them and spreading the idea, the seeds, the kernels of democracy around the world. You know, no, this isn't new. This is something that I've talked about for years. And you're right. I think he's destroying that.
Yeah, it's so, you know, I would say that it's penny smart and pound foolish, but I'm not even sure it's penny smart. It's just, it just strikes of, you know, grievance politics, retribution, and all things that do not really pertain to what are we trying to achieve here.
Well, the grievance part of it, and I'm glad you brought that up, is because, you know, I know a lot of people who have a hatred of, you know, especially when you're talking about Columbia and Harvard and the Ivy League schools. There's almost a hatred of those universities. Because, look, I know some pretty snotty Harvard grads. If you've ever run across one, you know, they're gonna be more than happy to tell you how much better than they are than you. But that's trickled down to a lot of folks that I know. So there's this general hatred now that seems to be percolating of people with higher education. And I think Trump has been one of the people who's kind of pushed that. So I look at this war on education that's going on, wanting to dismantle the Department of Education. That's going to harm low-income, poor, and working-class kids who are going to be able to go to schools across Pennsylvania and across the country because of dollars that flow out of that, Pell Grant, student loans, things like that. So I guess the question I have for you, if Trump gets what he wants, and we do dismantle all that and privatize student loans and do all that, what's that going to mean for working class kids who might not get a shot to attend one of the PASHE schools that have been the gem of Pennsylvania? What happens?
Yeah, our universities, and it's true of our universities and it's true of universities around the country, particularly talking about public regional universities, are the engines of the working class. That is, moving people from the lower working class into the middle class. And if you start robbing that and you take away that opportunity, you know, there's really no route for you to take. And it's true, you know, there'll be some positions in tech schools where you can make some money, good money, and certainly we don't disparage people from doing that. But, you know, if everybody's going to go there, first of all, you flood markets and then there's no need for the people. But then on top of that, too, even with those jobs, where people, what they don't tell you is, you know, it, unless they're union jobs, you're going to be in that position. And, you know, say you're making $70,000 coming or $80,000 coming right out of the tech school. That's going to be your salary. Like, you may get some adjustments for, you know, inflation. But generally speaking, that's the end of it. Like, you're doing the job and that's the cost of the job, right? Whereas, you know, sometimes those who graduate from college may start with less, but over time they earn more and more and more, and it keeps on growing. So, you know, it's really going to take, it's gonna hurt our economy, because we're not gonna have people who are gonna be buying things, who can afford to buy things. It's going to hurt the communities where universities are located, often very rural communities, often in very red, in red parts of the states. You know, it's just going to hurt the people that unfortunately seem to support the president the most or have supported him in the past. They are the ones who are going to get hurt the most over the long term. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff, you know, you're not going to see tomorrow. You may not see next year. It's going to be wearing down over the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And, you know, when it's too late, people are going to, you know, shake their fists and be angry. But the real thing is, who's putting us in a position where we're not going to succeed in the future?
Absolutely. And I would argue that by limiting these investments and destroying the Department of Education and cutting off Pell Grants and student loan opportunities and all of that stuff, and I think you're going to make inequality in this country that much worse. And that just benefits one group of people, the same folks who made out well in that one big, beautiful nightmare bill.
Yeah. You know, but let me give you some good news. I see some real activity going on, you know, not just in my union, but with the American Federation of Teachers, of whom we're an affiliate, but working with also the AAUP, and then other unions too, coming together and talking about how do we push back against this? How do we reshape the narrative that is going on? And for me, that's exciting, because it does come down, ultimately, all of this comes down to the people, because we're in an outside position when it comes to Washington. There's nobody, you know, fighting, or you can't depend on Congress, you can't depend on the courts, you can't depend certainly on the presidency. It means that it comes down to the people and what they're going to withstand. And I am encouraged by the fact that people are standing up and they are fighting back, and they, you know, they're working on different ways of getting messages across.
Well, no, and that's great to hear, because, you know, what I said on election night, and my audience is probably tired of hearing it, I said, you know, look, it's going to be a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, but the solutions to our problems are going to come out of the pain caused by their savagery, and they are being every bit of savage that I imagine they would be. I still think there's a lot of worse coming, but to hear that there's that organizing happening, that coming together and going, hey, this is where we need to be going, that's exciting stuff, and I think it gives hope.
Yeah, it does give hope, and it goes to, you know, in this country we've reached a point with union density that's pretty low, but unions really do provide that opportunity for people to get together, right, outside of government, to combine. That's what unions are about, right? They're about power, power through collective action. And the fact that the unions have been the ones standing up, and that is totally true, that it is the unions who have been pushing back, have been fighting in the courts, have been leading demonstrations. You know, I think people should take that not just as, oh, good, few people are fighting back, but with, how do I get involved with the union? Right? How do I get a union job?
Right there. Yep.
Because that's the real answer. because when you don't have governmental power, right, you need outside power, ways of coming together.
I was going to ask you last question. What should people do? You just said it. Join a union. Seems very, very simple. Seems like something we should be, I don't know, maybe working towards. But Ken, as always, I appreciate the time, the great information. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, Rick.
Our good friend Ken Mash is the president of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State and College Faculty, University Faculties. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
As Wisconsin as a game of cribbage with good friends, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Evening storms, otherwise partly cloudy tonight, a little hazy from smoke and lows in the upper 50s. And it still could be a touch hazy with sun tomorrow. Nice day though, highs in the mid-70s. And it stays nice on Friday, more sun and upper 70s. Currently at 62 degrees.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
NFL Hall of Famer, College Football Hall of Famer, Mr. Joe Thomas. You were telling us a little bit about being drafted number 3. You skipped the draft.
I went fishing that day, and I never did it for anything other than I just much rather spend the day fishing with my dad, and I'm hoping that that's a story that keeps being told and gives people a reason. Like, you know what, instead of working today, I'm going to go fishing with my kid. I'm going to make the time because it's impactful. It's memories that they're going to remember for the rest of their life.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, on Monday, I did something that I haven't done in a while. You know, since my wife's accident, I really haven't done those things that I used to do all the time. But on Monday, I gave myself the day. I got someone to come sit with Carol and just bailed. So the crew went and decided, let's go kayaking. So we headed over to the Delaware River, and the place where we launched from is a federal park. So the people who work there are federal employees, and it's owned by the federal government and all of that. When we drove in, something caught my eye. Now again, federal run park, that big sign, card only. They don't take federal dollars. No cash. No cash allowed at the federal park. And it made me go, you know, I'm amazed at how easily this whole card only thing has taken hold. And it's this whole crypto thing now scares me even more. So here to share some thoughts on, well, the Genius Act, the crypto, the move towards digital currency, and maybe I'm just a curmudgeon. I don't know. That's why I've asked Alexandra Thornton to come share some thoughts with us. She's a financial regulations guru over there at the Center for American Progress. My go-to person to kind of help me work through some of this. Alexandra, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here's my concern. Look, it's amazing to me how fast this card only thing is taking hold. Can't go to a sporting event, a concert, can't go anywhere without going, sorry, cash not accepted here. I fear eventually we get to the point where, you know, crypto only, baby, that's it. That's frightening to me.
Yeah, I think that there's an important distinction that we should make here to start out with, and that is, you know, we have everything in our financial system now digital. It's much of the financial system is digitally recorded. Banks record the money in your account in a digital ledger. Many people use a spreadsheet at home to keep track of their own assets instead of holding paper stock certificates, for example, in a physical folder. But that's very, very different. And I want to emphasize this. That's very, very different from crypto assets. that we're going to be talking about today, because those are actually, whether it's a stable coin, a Bitcoin or other crypto asset, those crypto assets themselves are digital. But the real trick about them is that you can trade them, you can transfer them from one person to another with no intermediary like a bank. And that has important ramifications, which I'm sure we'll discuss today.
So walk me through, what is this Genius Act? What is this? And you know, how does the Genius Act ensure that these digital currencies, like the stable coin that you referenced, that it's not going to lead right to a corporate control? Again, my big fear as a labor guy, we go right back to company script, the old company town model. What's in that that's going to stop anything like that?
Not too much, actually. So the legislation actually purports to regulate a specific kind of crypto asset, not all assets, not bitcoins, for example. It's a regulatory regime for stable coins. And stable coins are a particular type of crypto asset where the issuer claims is worth exactly one U.S. dollar. So one stable coin, one U.S. dollar. 98% of stable coins worldwide are pegged to the U.S. dollar. You can peg them to other currencies, but most are pegged to the U.S. dollar. So this legislation purports to sort of set up a framework of regulation around stable coins and the use of stable coins. But actually, it has a lot of gaps. There are many places in the legislation where Congress people couldn't come to an agreement on how to handle it. You know, some members raise concerns about financial stability and the treatment of consumers and all of that, and illicit financing of elections and so forth. And so they couldn't resolve them all, and they left it to the Treasury to close those gaps, to come up with rules. And there are about, I don't know, 10, maybe 10 different places in the bill that call for the Treasury Department to promulgate rules. And so those have not been done yet. And so there are a lot of open issues about how these are regulated. And I would caution your listeners to be very wary of using stable coins if they haven't before, and even if they do, because this is not like a green light. This is not safe like your deposits in a bank.
Because one of my concerns is you know, I know there's been some information coming out of the Trump administration allowing pension funds to get into crypto, allowing mortgages to be written with using crypto as assets. And you know, the fluctuation for me is kind of frightening. It appears to me that we're setting up another 2008, and you know, something that Alan Greenspan said at the time, or why they couldn't regulate what the securities that they were doing is because it was such a complex financial instrument. And then his response was, "We didn't know people would commit fraud." This seems to me, and again, as an outsider, not a financial person, this seems to me to be another one of those really complex things that maybe you shouldn't be playing with.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right to be concerned about that. This is a weak regulatory structure that's being set up for stable coins. There is no regulatory oversight structure for any other kind of crypto asset. So basically, this weak structure is a similar kind of thing to what happened in the 2008 financial crisis. In 2000, there was something called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and that was supposed to provide a regulatory regime for over-the-counter market trading of complex financial products called derivatives. And none of that matters except to the point that like we have with crypto assets today, they decided to kind of create a special regime, actually an almost non-existent regime, for swaps, which was a particular kind of derivative. And as anybody who's read anything about the financial crisis knows, swaps became multi-trillion dollar market. People started, engaging in swaps derivatives. And ultimately, it was swaps that contributed to the 2008 financial crisis. Right. The lack of transparency, the lack of oversight resulted in an inefficient market where the end users were prevented from making informed investment decisions, even while the dealers in swaps were reaping huge profits.
And again, I come back to, you know, right now crypto is overwhelmingly held by a handful, a very small percentage of the population. And right. What I do know is every time there's one of these newfangled things, one of these situations where we're setting up the next bubble to go burst, I know it's working people who end up taking it on the chin. And I'd like to try not to have that happen.
Yeah, that's smart, because there are a lot of risks for consumers here. As I said, you know, consumers will take money out of their bank accounts potentially to buy stable coins. And that money is insured in a bank. It's backed up by the FDIC up to like $250,000 per account. But when they buy stable coins, there is no such insurance. And if those stable coins are lost for any reason, they're just gone. Poof. That's it.
So my fear then, Alexandra, of this being the next bubble that we're going to end up bailing out, is that something that I should, that is warranted or unwarranted given what you just said? Because there's part of me that goes, every time rich people get themselves into trouble, it's the poor and the working class that come racing to their aid, not the other way around, but or at least my view. Curious.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right to be concerned about that, because essentially what you're going to have is, you know how when people get worried about a bank not being in a stable condition, there are runs on the funds in the bank? Well, the same thing can happen with stable coins, only worse. And because the stable coin issuer is actually, they're supposed to buy assets to back up the stable coins so that they can redeem them if the person who owns the stable coins wants to redeem them for cash. So they invest in these treasury bonds or whatever they invest in, and they may hold them in a bank. So the banks and the stable coin issuers are connected. So you have that much more risk with these lightly regulated stable coin issuers and runs on stable coins causing contagion in the market. And as we all know, that often ends up with taxpayers bailing them out.
So before I move on to the conspiracy theory stuff, your expert opinion, good, bad, was this the right move? Because my first thought was, you know, Democrats should not have voted for this. I get why Republicans did, but Democrats shouldn't have. You're just giving another reason to hate you when things go bad. So any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that, you know, the fact that not many people are actually involved in crypto is a really important point here. In 2024, less than 8% of the population actually engaged in crypto in any way. So it's not clear that many people care much about crypto. And I think that the crypto industry saw an opening to take action, and they'll, of course, benefit from this in a way that's similar to the budget reconciliation bill, for example, where we saw in that bill, and I'm sure you talked to your listeners about that, where, you know, that had a lot of benefits for wealthy people in terms of the size of the tax breaks and so forth. Meanwhile, in that same bill, those tax cuts were partially paid for by cuts to Medicaid and SNAP. And so it's a similar kind of thing with crypto. The crypto industry will win big from this, but it's not clear that the average consumer will.
Because my problem is this is opening the door. Maybe it's not bad yet. Maybe this isn't going to trickle down yet to right. We, the working class. But I know it never stops. The ball keeps rolling. And I have some Red Hat friends. Some of my MAGA friends who over the last couple of years have been very concerned about China's social credit score and how Democrats were going to bring that here. And I kept going, no, we wouldn't tolerate such a thing. But I'm watching how quickly we've moved to, you know, doing our own checking out at the grocery store, now going to concerts or whatever and only using a credit card and not digging in your pocket and using cash. It seems, I don't know, it just seems the seamless transition away from dollars and cents into a digital currency that, sadly, I look to the history that we're going to go back to the future of company towns. And Elon Musk's already got a company town having his own crypto, or much ado of nothing.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there's going to be a proliferation of these stable coins, and it will be, you know, actually consumers, as I said, they aren't using this much, and they are very wary of crypto at this point in time. And as long as they understand that this legislation doesn't really improve the situation in terms of the safety of crypto, I think they will be very wary, and perhaps they won't buy into the whole stable coin thing. Why would you want to buy something with a stable coin when you can just use cash or even your credit card, and you don't have to pay transaction fees, at least for the stable coin?
For now. Right? For now.
Right. You know, exactly. It could change. Although this legislation does say that stable coins can't provide interest. Now, you get interest on the money you have in a bank account, so why would you want to hold your money in the form of stable coins? You know, and your stable coin wallet won't be insured. And another really important thing for your listeners to remember is that if you get a bunch of stable coins from one company, you probably won't be able to use those stable coins with another company. You'll have to pay a fee to transfer them, convert them back in, or redeem them for cash. And then you can use it to buy another stable coin or buy something else. So it's not as easy as it sounds. There are companies trying to change that by offering more universal stable coins. But at some point, it starts to look like the dollar, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, at the end of it, my concern is we've already got that instrument. It's called the dollar. Why are we recreating something else that's in the hands of most people who would own them? Probably can't tell you who controls whatever coin they've got, or whatever digital asset, or where it comes from, or how it comes from. And that again, I go back to the concern being we just returned to a company town where you work for a company, they control all of your assets, all of your spending. And the other thing is, you know, with all of this stuff, you know, top to bottom, you know, the concern for me is always, you know, I went to the park the other day. Now somebody knows that. You know, so much for freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think another thing to remember is that, you know, all these companies, when they issue stable coins, they're going to have access to your bank account information. And so that is going to be another, you know, more proliferation of companies that have access to consumers' personal financial data. And that's along the lines of what you're talking about. It's definitely a concern.
Yeah. No, I mean, so because it's been pitched to me and it helped me here, because I admittedly, I don't know as much as I want to. I don't get it. But it seems to me that this is a way that potentially you could centralize, you know, the entire global banking system, or is that just a step too far conspiratorially?
Well, I think the crypto industry does have a vision of having all credit cards and payments and everything being done in crypto. But as we've talked about, there are a number of really big problems. There's also, in addition to financial stability, there are national security problems. You know, we have this great infrastructure that's already set up that protects people's cash when they put it in banks and so forth, and when they pay for things in cash. And that financial structure is not being replicated fully with crypto. And people should just be really aware of that. And so it's hard to imagine that this will become a universally used thing. But
I sure
we'll
hope
see.
Not. But, you know, again, if you would have asked me before the pandemic if I wouldn't be able to spend my dollar, the money I have in my pocket, if I wouldn't be able to spend that in about half of the places I go to, I would have said, no, in this country, we'd have never tolerated that.
Right.
But I went to a federal park where they don't take federal dollars.
Yeah.
They only take Mr. Visa or Mr. American Express or Google Pay or something on my phone, not their dollars. And that's, you know, maybe I'm just a little getting old, but I didn't think this would happen this quickly.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that the industry is really pushing it through because they stand to benefit greatly from it. And so we'll have to see how far it gets. But I think that in the meantime, your listeners should be super wary and careful about this.
100% agree. Alexandra, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always great seeing you. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Alexandra Thornton, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer of Federal Regulations over there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you on the crypto bandwagon? You think it's going to be the future? Or are you just, have you gotten used to using the phone to pay for everything? I want to hear it. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day that U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed Medicare into law. This federally funded health care program provides assistance to one of the country's most vulnerable populations, the elderly. At the time the law was enacted, many seniors found it difficult, if not impossible, to get private health insurance. President Johnson signed the law in a ceremony in Independence, Missouri, the hometown of former President Harry Truman. While in office in the 1940s, Truman had proposed a national health insurance plan. Unfortunately, he was unable to get his plan through Congress. President Johnson wanted to recognize Truman's efforts. At the bill signing ceremony, President Truman received the very first symbolic Medicare card. The law went into full effect in 1966. 19 million people registered for the benefit. One of the labor leaders who fought for Medicare was Nelson Hale Cruikshank. Nelson held several positions for the AFL-CIO, and he spent his career advocating for social insurance protections for working people. He earned the nickname the Father of Medicare. The same year that the Medicare law was passed, Cruikshank explained why he thought it was so important to reform health insurance. He said, quote, "In too many doctors' offices today, the Hippocratic Oath has given way to the Dow Jones average. By 2010, 48 million Americans received their health insurance through the Medicare program. 8 million were people with disabilities. The rest were seniors. The program has had a tremendous impact on the quality of life of millions of older Americans. Yet, since its inception, there have been those who aim to make it less accessible by scaling back benefits and raising the eligibility age."
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So before I get a flood of emails coming in to educate me on crypto and digital currency, I know there's a difference. But again, you know, for me, my concern is that at some point they become one and the same. It is amazing to me how quickly we've accepted the things that have been forced upon us by corporate America. The self-checkout thing to me is just amazing. People just flock to it. In fact, the other day we were at the supermarket, there were people waiting in line to check themselves out while the cashier was standing there looking at her phone because nobody was coming through. They've already trained you to do it. And, you know, it's I go to sporting events or to concerts and you hear people complaining, they only take credit card. And most people are probably going to pay with their credit card anyway. But the fact that that choice has been taken from you, that quote unquote, that freedom has been taken from you. And it's not going to stop there. It's only going to get worse. And as I look at the digital currencies, reminds me of the move to ATMs. Everyone got an ATM card because, oh, you know, you could use the automated banker. You don't have to go inside. And they laid off a bunch of bank tellers and kind of moved you in that direction where I don't want to wait in line. I just want to get 20 bucks out or whatever. And it was free. In fact, at the beginning, they paid you. It was like a quarter every time you used it. They got you, hey, this is pretty easy. I like that. And you got a quarter out of the deal. Then that quarter went away rather quickly. And then, well, now they charge you to get your money. And I see this as the same way. Whoever's going to control the system is going to control the transactions. And that's when then the conspiratorial stuff comes in. What do they do with all the information that they're gathering from your purchase of Cheetos or whatever? You know, is it going to come to a point to where, you know, we looked at your grocery bill and, you know, you had a lot of red meat, so that heart attack you had, we're not going to cover. Or, you know, your diabetes is getting out of hand. It's because, you know, you bought those ding-dongs or whatever. Is that coming? When they decide that they no longer want to issue dollars and coins, because I guess we're doing away with the penny now, and nobody seemed to put up a stink about that. How far does it go? And yeah, while I understand there's a difference between them, my concern is that we end up with one currency, you know, like the dollar. And Alexandra was right. We've got a system, works pretty well, pretty secure. Why you would want to get into crypto? You want to invest? You want to gamble? If you're one of those folks who wants to gamble, I guess, good luck. Because everything that seems to go up, you know, finds its way back down. My concern is that when the bubble bursts, and they do, these bubbles, they go pop. My concern is that it's the working poor who are going to end up paying the consequences. Because these crypto companies, they don't have any assets. There's nothing there. There's no one backing. There's no backing, as I understand. It goes belly up. There's nothing to go get. If you buy a stock, you invest in a company, at least when the company goes belly up, you sell off the company's assets, you divvy up what's left. There's something there. But this, nothing. Poof, gone. So for me, my concern, we end up with another one of these really complex financial tools that ends up jabbing the worker in the back. You know, you remember 2008 was not fun for most working people across this country. But good news on the horizon. And thank you to Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, Sean, my Teamster president, Sean O'Brien's favorite Republican, or one of them. But he's introduced a piece of legislation that's going to give free money, tariff checks, $600 for every adult, every child. You know, everyone's getting it, kind of like the stimulus that we got during the pandemic, but a little tariff welfare. And it's interesting because, you know, they were running around saying that tariffs aren't going to raise the price of things, and now realizing that the reality is yeah, kind of going to. Now, look, I've said from all along, I'm not an anti-tariff person. I think Trump's going to booger this up, and he is. I do think prices are going to go up because of just how broad-based they are and because they're preparing us for it. And look, as long as we're using a digital currency, we're not going to have to dig in our pocket and actually count out money. It's just going to come out. But this $600, this could be the answer. This could make that one big, beautiful nightmare pill a little bit easier to swallow. And finally today, for my tinfoil hat crowd. You got that tinfoil hat under the red hat. You know who you are. Republicans right now, they're moving to push some legislation to stop weather modification. Yep, no more chemtrails, no more causing hurricanes, no more whipping up a tornado, no more of that stuff. No more space. I'm sorry. I had someone the other day tell me that the reason that it's raining so much is because government wants us on edge. They want to make us unhappy. This is the theory. They want to make us unhappy at President Trump for misusing the rainmaker, because, you know, his economy is doing so well, and that all of his promises and all of his pledges are coming true, and the country's back again, and the liberals want to, I guess, you go from there, figure out the rest, because it's ridiculous. But anyway, they're going to move on some legislation that should really, you know, make the conspiracy theories online, you know, skyrocket. But they've introduced and they are passing and enacting some laws to ban weather modification and environmental geoengineering. No more chemtrails. No more lasers, no more any of that stuff. It means that just God is going to be angry with us, which is weird, because if we really were that Christian nation that we're told, as much as it's been raining and as angry as some of the storms have been, if that were true, that God were angry every time a storm happened, he's ticked. Or she, however you want to look at that. Somebody really unhappy. So there you go. No more chemtrails. No more whipping up the storms. Our government in action. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You will most certainly find ours. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Leave comments, all of that. Like, subscribe, share, do all that stuff. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Hearings began today on the deadly crash of an American Airlines flight and a Black Hawk helicopter over Washington in January. NTSB Chairman Jennifer Homendy blamed bureaucratic paralysis within the FAA that prevented it from heeding warnings from air traffic controllers.
Why did it take 67 lives to be lost and families who are just destroyed forever to understand what was occurring, to realize that you had helicopters flying under civilian aircraft?
In Gaza, over the last 24 hours, at least 7 people have died due to malnutrition, at least 37 people killed and 270 injured attempting to get food. A jury has convicted Colorado dentist James Craig of murder for poisoning his wife's protein shakes. Sentenced to life, no parole. President Trump's administration has negotiated a 15% tariff on goods from South Korea. This is ABC News.